Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my three decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba. Welcome to episode 43. I'm Mark DeLuzio with my good friend and colleague from a long time ago, who's now working as a managing director with Lean Horizons, John Boucher. John, how are you?
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing good. Great. I know you got a big Australian trip coming up, so
I
wanted to get a couple episodes in before we send you off on an airplane. We never know if you're going to come back. So
get the most out of me now. That's right.
Well, it's a beautiful country. You know, I've been there a few times, and people there are great as well. But anyway, John, we got a request on our Lean 911 email to talk about the seven flows. And I'm sure people are sitting out there saying, what the heck is that? Right. And it's not something that you're going to find in your common literature out there, simply because, well, I'll let you talk about Chihiro Nakao, who was my mentor and sensei, and also yours in a really big way. You were more or less an apprentice of his, which the experience that he gave you was you just can't buy it anywhere. And Nakao, to me, is the best engineer in the world. By the way, I just interviewed Art Byrne on for the third time the other day, and he agreed about Nakao being the world's best engineer.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the world's best. Yeah. And
that's not an overstatement. He is.
No. That's right. And he just sees things differently. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. But these seven flows really came from how you took his teachings, made notes, and developed the whole thought around this. You know, Nakao's not the kind of guy to do a PowerPoint presentation, right? And he isn't going to, you know, give you a manual. He will talk to you and make you think about all kinds of different things, which we'll get into today. So, John, I'm going to turn it over to you. And again, John Boucher, with a over 30-year career with General Electric, he, in my opinion, next to Nakao, is the best moonshine/3P guy on the planet. I haven't met anybody that comes close to John. And not only is he unbelievably technically, John, but you philosophically get it. And at a level that most people don't even know how to get to. So it's just incredible how you pull all that together. Starting out as a tool and die apprentice, working your way through up with a couple master's degrees in manufacturing engineering. And there's some incredible experience that you've done. And you're actually taking some of our clients today and just turning their industries upside down. And nobody's going to be able to touch them. Maybe we'll talk more about that some other day. But John, I want you to talk about the seven flows. If you don't, I'm going to turn it over and shut my big mouth, and I'll throw in my comments as we go through. But let's talk about the seven flows. What are the seven flows and how they all come to be?
Let's do it. Thank you, Mark. So, hey, as always, you and I talk a few days a week, but it's always great where like-minded people get to exchange some ideas. And what I love about these sessions is it goes beyond you and I and the core team, as we get to share things that we've learned with other people. So the seven flows, I'm going to kind of go back in time. I first met Nakao in 98. So in GE in 98, we had been using Shingajitsu for a little while. Thought we were doing great until we met Nakao, and he set us on a completely different path. So I still recall, so the genesis of seven flows and how I was taught. And then I'll give the description of what it is. It goes back to a day in early 99. Nakao was at our shop. He came by my office. He saw I had a big library that I was proud of. He took all these books off my shelf between his hands and threw them into the hallway. And I'm sure the interpreter did not tell me what he actually said. But anyhow, his point was, hey, all this stuff is wrong. And one of the things he picked on, I'm not going to dwell on this, I'll just mention it quickly, is the Learning to See book. So look, the learning the C book, we got a lot of advantages out of it. Part of pop culture with Lean, it really helped people at least talk about Lean. But he took a lot of issues and exceptions with that. And he said, that's not what I told those guys. They made a lot of this stuff up. Why don't you come with me and I'll tell you what this really is. It's the seven flows of production. That was early 99. In September of 99, I went with him on what he called Super KPO, the Super Kaizen Promotion Office, 3 weeks. I was with Sensei for 3 weeks. We did...
In Japan.
Yes, in Japan.
Yeah,
we did
right.
17 businesses in 13 cities in 3 weeks. And every second of every day, I was a student. He was teaching. I had to do a lot of things. It was very intense. So with the seven flows, one of the things he wanted to do is teach me how to do a site diagnostic. And so you can think about learning to see and do the value stream mapping, which I still did in GE. I always did it. I always had people working on that for my Hoshin planning. But the seven flows is a little deeper. What makes the seven flows unique? You and I talk about this. The Nakao paradigm is flow. He starts with the answer. The answer is it has to flow. And so the processes have to be next to each other. So the way he taught me to think, John, if you start with the answer, you need flow. What you have to do is find out anytime you don't have flow. So it's similar to value stream mapping in that regard, I think. But so here's a guy, Mark. He never starts with a tools-based approach, does he?
Never.
Never. Never once have I heard him say, you need a Kanban system or you need a pull. Nope. 100% of the time, you don't have flow right here. And so then he would say, so you either need to moonshine your concept or do this or do that to make sure you have flow.
You know, John, just to take a moment
context.
For a minute.
Yeah.
Just take a moment for a moment. Just, and there's all kinds of different people listening to this. And some people are very seasoned, some people, you know, in the middle, and some very new. So I just want to make flow very simple. The part never stops. Period. That's it. And if you want to, I always like to use non-business analogies. I do that mm-hmm. for SMED and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Think about water going through a garden hose.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, we all know that's flows, right? I mean, that's water flows, right? But water going through a garden hose, and there's no stoppage unless you have a kink in the hose. Nakao detests the kinks in manufacturing. He wants you to flow, and the part should never stop. That's it. And that doesn't mean you set it on a conveyor, okay? It may mean a moving line time to tack time, but it means the part never stops.
That's
okay?
Right,
and it continues to flow. Yep. So.
Yep. And then I think later, not in this session, but we're going to do another deep dive on, you can't put it on a 1,000-foot conveyor either. You have to be adding value to it. But I think that's for another session.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
But, you know, I just saw a couple things on LinkedIn about a conveyor that just took a part and nothing happened to the part. But
I
tell you what, we had some great technology moving that part throughout the factory. Okay. And it's like, well, why are we automating one of Ono's seven wastes? Waste from transportation.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
I'm sorry.
Right.
I had to just throw that in there about flow.
Yeah, great. That's a great ad. It's a great ad. So, but without that, the audience might be missing context for this. So with Nakao, who is the master, the answer is always flow. You're always working your way toward that. And the results of that, of course, are the low short lead times, the low inventory, all the stuff that everybody wants. You get that through creating flow or physically connecting your processes. Yeah. So when again, I'm back to 99, where it was the first deep dive. And then I became, let's say, a practitioner. Afterward, I had to practice what I learned. And through the practice, I was able to refine the thinking and get to some of the consolidated notes that I'll share with you today. Maybe everybody's curious, what are the seven flows? So look, the number seven, let's talk about that for a minute. I think this is more superstition than anything in Japan. Why not eight? Why not five? I don't know. So it's seven. Material. Materials divided into three different types of materials you want to look at. The flow of raw material, the flow of sub-assemblies, and the flow of assembly. And so look, sometimes a shop won't have sub-assembly. Don't sweat it. Look at your raw material. Look at how the raw material is changing. Where does it go? How does it get fed into something that you ship the customer? So you've got the flow of materials. You've got the, so that's three. You've got the flow of information.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the flow of equipment. You've got the flow of engineering. And then you have the flow of people. Mm-hmm. And so together we have seven. So maybe what I can do is just take the audience here through one by one. What does it mean? What are you looking for? How do you want to think about each of the flows?
Yeah, and I think you've documented questions that you have to ask. In this case, let's just say materials. You're asking of the materials. And by the way, these are really easy questions to comprehend. Mm-hmm. Incredibly difficult, though, to do.
Yeah. And so I would say my suggestion to anybody listening is, like anything in life, you've got to practice it. And you get a few people. So for people that are listening that are part of a lean team somewhere, you know, get the team together. Do what I did early on. I would take a Friday afternoon, get a few people together, and we would practice some of this. And look, we went out for beers at the end of the day. So we had a little bit of fun with it. And then we started to make it part of our operations planning. And I'll get to that here in a little bit.
So when you do that, let me ask you, when you do that with your team, did they start seeing the factory differently?
They loved it. Well, I'll answer it like this. At my retirement party, many, many, many people thanked me for all of our teamwork over the years, but also said, hey, you now have given me the curse, John.
Yeah, you ruined them.
Mark, maybe we do a whole nother session about what this does to some people's career. Because it'll put them at odds with how a big or small company thinks when they start to see this with clarity.
Yeah, it really has changed. And sometimes I'm not trying to, you know, be arrogant here or pat myself on the back. Sometimes I go into a business and sometimes I think I'm the only one who sees it the way it's being seen through my eyes. Yeah. And it is a curse sometimes because our job is to get ever the people to see through the same glasses that we have on. So, okay, John, go ahead on materials.
Okay. So for the materials, I'm going to go through the questions and just talk about the philosophy of how this is set up.
Sure.
And the way that you want to think about this is you actually interrogate the parts. Yeah, the parts can't talk back, of course. But what you want to do is ask these probing questions. And if you can't see the answers around you, that's the gap. You're doing a gap assessment. You can do it alone. You can do it with people. But what you're looking for is you're not necessarily looking for how things flow. You're looking for when they don't flow. And so when you get to materials, I won't delineate between raw, sub, and assembly.
Yeah,
materials
right.
in general has the same set of questions. So you might be on the back dock. You might be at receiving. You might be somewhere in the shop. You look at materials. First question is, what are you? And if you can't find the answer somewhere, you make a note. It's not clear. So let's just pause there. Before I even go any further, what you're looking for is the same philosophical points that you might read in the Harvard Business Review article, Decoding the DNA of the Toyota Production System. And they had the four principles, and one of them was how things connect, right? And you've got this unambiguous way that information is passed. So you're looking for an unambiguous way that things would happen. You're searching for the standards. What are you? So if you can't answer the question, there's a good chance that you're going to get lost if you're the parts. What are you? I don't know if you're the right thing. So what are you? How many of you are there? Should there be that many?
Mm.
So ask it that way. What you're trying to do is frame this up. Okay, you're part number X. And should you be part number X? Should there be three of you? Should there be five of you? I hope this is easy for people to latch onto the first set of questions.
By the way, John, what you just described, I said earlier, hard to do, incredibly hard to do. And if you took that litmus test across your factory or your office for that matter, you know, and ask that question, the whole idea here is, what's our standard?
Right.
And how do I know there's an abnormality when that standard is not being met? So, for example,
exactly.
If visually I've got it laid out that I need 50 of these parts in that spot, okay, and it's clearly identified as to what I am, and there's 80 parts there, it should be very visible and clear to anybody walking by, including a dumb consultant like me, to say, hey, that's not normal there. You guys have 30 too many. Is that right? Did I say 70? 20 too many. Okay. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
you're spot on.
Idea of standardization and visual management, you know, we talk about Gemba boards, which you and I are going to talk about next episode, but you know, the visual management aspect of a factory is, does that really belong there? Okay.
Right.
Why is that there? This is a great, those three questions right there are, I have to probably argue most companies cannot pass that first test you just passed here.
That's right. So let's think about the genius of Nakao for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So what you mentioned with the standards. So I'm sure that everybody that's going to watch this is somehow involved in Lean. They've heard about the standards. Okay. You see how Nakao's teaching this? He's teaching it from a different angle. He was teaching me to, John, we talk about standards and you need the standards. Yes, here's a different way to get at the same thing. When you walk up to a part and look at it and ask the part, who are you? How many of there are you? How many should be? That is a more refined way to get at the standards.
Well, how many people drew yellow squares on the floor and put stuff there that don't satisfy these questions? I see it all the time. You know?
All the time. And then that gets to, so it'll get to the next set of questions.
Sure.
Again, you're looking at the part, interrogating the part. Where did you come from?
Mm-hmm.
Are you in the right place? Point you're making. Should you be here? Then it gets a little tougher. How old are you? How long have you been here? How long are you supposed to be here? Where do you go next? When should you go there? How do you know where to go next? How will you get where you need to go?
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, John, it's interesting because you and I have talked about this so many times that, you know, the consulting industry in general likes to segregate the tools because it's easy to sell it that way. Hey, I'm going to come in and do 5S.
That's it.
I'm going to come in and do standard work. I'm going to come in and do SMED, right? And it's a nice, easy way to package consulting services. But I'm looking at this, and so much of this is going to, excuse the pun is intended, flow into the section of the flows called information.
That's
okay.
Right.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, so
that's right,
these all of these are Venn diagrams.
They're all Venn diagrams. You and I talk about that all the time.
Yeah.
And Mark, I'm not sure how often you talk about that in these podcasts.
I do.
Everything's a Venn diagram. This is where a lot of consultants get people into trouble. It is they can't see life as a Venn diagram.
Well,
and they can't teach lean as a Venn diagram.
it's a way of thinking about this.
Yeah.
It's a way of thinking about what we do. And it's, they're not, these do not stand by them. Nothing stands by itself. But okay, I'll let you continue. This is phenomenal.
Well, it's the same as the human.
Do we stop
body,
there? Because nobody's going to answer those questions. Come back in another year?
Why do you ask them? You're doing an assessment. So it's a way to do an assessment to say, okay, here's the things we have to work on. And then the other thought about the seven flows, again, Mark, the Venn diagram, you can do them individually or you can do them together, but you can never do just one without the other six.
Right.
Six.
Right,
and
right.
I know material has three. So as an example, at our client in India, when I had them redo the layout, I had them do the seven flows and think an AutoCAD system. You lay them all on top of each other. And so you can't just say, you know, what's my flow of information? It has to be all on top of each other.
Right.
Did the material flow with these types of questions? Did the people flow? Can the equipment flow? Boom, boom, boom. And one of the ways I use this is not just for business planning, but also, especially when you're doing 3P and you're doing layouts.
Yep. Yep. By the way, John, I like to think of it a little differently. Again, I like to go outside the realm of business. I'm Italian. So when you make lasagna, you start with the pasta.
Yeah.
Maybe a little mozzarella. Okay. Then you layer in some bolognese and then maybe another layer of pasta. And okay. I'm sorry. I had to bring that in. I have to bring in food somehow into this.
I'm thinking the wrong way. I should think food.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Anyway. Maybe a good visual way. Okay, so this is awesome.
It maybe because what I'd like to do next is just do the flow of information, because that's the most likely.
It ties in. Yep.
It ties in, Mark. So, yep. Mark, I think you're going to make these slides available for people. And if somebody were to ask for the slides and you send them to them, one of the things I talk about.
Yeah,
is,
I'll give the email out at the end, John, and okay. We will. And if anybody wants a copy of these slides that have these flows indicated, we'll definitely send those out to you. Yeah. So
okay, and so Mark, now, what I did when I had my page on information, I just keep thinking about some of the people I learned from in GE. So yes, you and I learned from the senseis. But students like us learn from everybody.
Yep.
You learn good and bad. But I remember when I first joined GE, the old guys, the guys are our age now.
Hey, watch it.
Hey, they were part of the greatest generation. So I joined GE and GE Aircraft Engines my first 9 years. The greatest generation. So this business that built jet engines post-World War II. Some of the best materials guys I ever met were in GE Aviation, aircraft engines. Well, Mark, so they came out of the wartime, then you go into the military and commercial engine building, but they didn't have the systems that we have today. There's no SAP or Oracle, but we all know they still made their output. They made everything happen. They shipped engines with good quality. They shipped them on time. Everything was visual. So I'm old enough now I can look back at my career. I learned from those guys. Then I started to learn from the senseis in you. Then these, let's say, computer systems, IT takes on a bigger meaning in industry. And so I'm old enough now where first it was AS/400 systems and simple stuff.
Remember
then
those.
It was the Oracle and the SAP and all the MES systems and everything that ties. And so what I have seen with my own eyes and in my own organizations is things on materials especially get worse.
By the way, you said that the legacy guys that were the best material guys and the greatest generation did not have SAP and did not have Oracle.
Yep.
Lucky them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lucky them.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I
things were.
digress.
And so we're trying to claw our way back, in a sense, claw our way back to that point in time where things need to be visual. The whole team needs to
Right.
see it, understand it. And that's what the senseis always advocate. So when we talk about information, look, we can't separate ourselves from the real world. These systems aren't going away. Nobody's going to take them out. We've got to learn to live with them, which is something that I worked on pretty hard in the last 20 years or so. So let's think about information.
Sure.
Now, with parts, it's easier. I think everybody knows what we mean by a part. With information, maybe if you see my slides, I call it a value object. So
yep.
What's your value object? And so you can't interrogate information the way that you could interrogate parts. And so what you have to do is think about what information is supposed to be connected to your value object. So you've got to interrogate the value object and the required information at the same time. So the term that the senseis used, and I kept it in here, in the year 2024, maybe people don't use it as much, but is the information and your value object married? Are they married? And so, sensei, what do you mean married? Oh, are they together? You want to make sure they never get divorced. I said, oh, okay, tell me again about marriage and divorce for materials. Oh, John, if the information's with the part for a little while, and then the part is someplace else in the factory and there's no information, it got divorced and that's not good. Your part's going to get lost and nothing good is going to happen. And so in general, that's how he wanted me to think about that in terms of marriage and divorce. But what he's after is, are the relationships one-to-one? So meaning this one-to-one relationship, you've got a value object and the information that ties to the value object. So what we look for are those one-to-one relationships, and the value object could be a production schedule, could be your SMED schedule, it could be your TPM schedule, it could be bolts you need, it could be fill the blank in. So when I do these assessments, I just make sure that the team gives the boundary condition of what value objects we're going to look at. And so are they one-to-one in terms of physical relationship, meaning is the information with the value object? But there's more. The element of timing. So now I started to think about what JIT and especially TAC time gives us is this element of timing. And one of the biggest issues I've seen with, it could be the MES or one of the core systems, is we get disassociated with timing. So, give you an example. Somebody might move, I'll make it real easy, 5 pallets of something to the warehouse to ship, or to the shipping dock, I'm sorry. They move 5 pallets to ship. 2 days later, they transact the system and told the system that's what they did. That's what you're searching for. So we talk about the one-to-one relationships, one-to-one physical relationship, but you need a one-to-one timing relationship. If you physically move something, especially out of an area, you've got to find a way to immediately tell the system you did it.
Well,
otherwise, yeah, go ahead.
You know what occurred to me here, John? So you go back to the material flow that you talked about earlier. Let's say you satisfy all those things. But then you do what you just said, and the material gets divorced from the information. So just because you satisfied it on day one, and then you divorce the information, you just broke the first set of rules,
which is
the material flow. You just lost it. You just lost it. So it's not that, hey, I checked the box, I'm okay. It's like, wait, you gotta live with the life of the part in this case. You know, that those rules have to hold throughout the life of that product.
They do. It's a great point, Mark. It's a great point. What is the life cycle of your value object?
Yeah.
And that's what you're after. So you're back to your hose with water. The beauty of flow, when you start, there's only one place for it to come out.
Yep.
And in the beginning, things are separated and disassociated. And so all we're trying to do is take those disassociations and put them all together somehow, make a plan to put them together.
By the way, unless my grandkids take the hose and spray me with it, then the target changes. Okay, but you know, one thing occurred to me here, John.
Yeah,
Nikhil taught us, and I know he taught you as well, about Kanban. He said he's now you remember Kanban, which means signboard, right? In translated, sign, right? Is everybody thinks Kanban's about material flow. And it is, but it's also about information flow. You look at what's on a Kanban card, all those things, where to come from, where's it going, how often, how many, how often has to move. Right. You know, Kanban's about information, but here's what Nikhil told me, and I think he told you the same. He says, listen, when we first started working with him, like 10 years earlier than you did, in 1987, 88, I don't understand. Americans love Kanban. Why? Why? He says, we should flow first.
Yep.
Flow first, he says. We automatically go to Kanban. We love Kanban, he says. Then he laid a line on me that's in our training material. Kanban is an admission of failure to do one piece flow. That is a totally different way to think about Kanban.
And you know, I love and subscribe to everything you just said. And so look, I'll tell you, later in my career, when the company was going through a lot of changes, we had a lot of people from outside come in. Everything was tools based, and all those people wanted to do was Kanban. So for some of my old team that's watching this, they're going to know exactly what I'm referring to.
I used to tell the guys at Danaher, let's call it can't ban. Can't. Yeah. Not can. Okay. You can't ban. Yeah. You can't do it until you challenge yourself.
That's right. Well, just the power of how. And so in information, you could create, I don't know, a whole something just on information. All I'm doing is scratching the surface here, where you start to think about the relationship of information to the value object. Then the timing associated with it. So think about the disassociation is the poison. And what I've seen a lot in my operations, again, we would get really disconnected on material transactions. We would take physical inventory. All of a sudden, there's $5 million of material we can't find. This is inexcusable. None of that should ever happen. And a lot of it is the way these systems are designed. So all I do is advocate a Kaizen of this. It's not a Kaizen of the system. It's a Kaizen of how, when, and where you do the transactions. It's as simple as that. So also, you want to connect this. You mentioned the Gemba boards, because that is information. So the way I think about this is the information current or old news? Nikhil hated all that stuff because it was too old. And what he would say is there's nothing you could do with it. So what would happen is, in a case like that, the way I think about it and what I used to tell my team is it turned from metrics to statistics. Think about baseball. Yeah, okay. I don't know. Baseball has so many statistics associated with it. Somebody might say, yeah, they might give you something that's an FYI. And you look at one of these shops, the Gemba board is just a big FYI. There's nothing actionable. And I tie that back to the relationship of information and the timing to the value object. I tie it directly back.
Well, you know, John, on one of my previous episodes, I talk about leading and lagging indicators. Most Gemba boards are lagging indicators you cannot use to solve problems. And I talked about that on that episode.
Yep.
By the way, one of the other things about information is, what about the quality information? The quality, you know, you and I are going to do an episode down the road, maybe when you get back from Australia, on how do we define a defect? Okay. And every time I've asked that question, the answer is, when our product doesn't meet our product specifications. Yeah, really. Well, what if it meets the specifications and the customer thinks it sucks? Okay. And what about the quality of information? What about the fact that your sales guy didn't get the right specifications and you went to build that machine and now you have to rework it? Okay.
So, I mean, a million ways about defects.
We'll talk about
that. I know we need to do a separate episode on that because the veracity of the information, this becomes a huge problem.
Yeah.
A huge problem. So I think one of the reasons I just go back to, and I don't want to derail our core conversation here, but so again, we talk about the
Gamble. By the way, John, not to interrupt, we're getting into Venn diagrams, aren't we?
It's always a Venn diagram.
See how that works? All right, keep me on track here, okay? I'll keep you on track. I'm supposed to keep you on track.
Well, I'll forget. We'll do that okay. My other thought.
Okay,
save it. I'm going to keep going on this. So awesome. I'll just talk a little bit about the flow of equipment. And so
before you do that, I have a little anecdote I need to tell you. With Nikau. Okay. I was with him at one of our new acquisitions at Danaher, and the quality guy came up to Nikau with a quality report, and it happened to be all the quality stuff data from the previous week. And I think I've told you the story before, John, and I think I might have mentioned it on another episode. So Nikau looked at the report, he saw the date on it. He ripped it in half, threw it on the floor, and stomped on it. Okay. And the quality guy's just standing there looking at Nikau because he didn't know Nikau. I knew Nikau. I've been with him so many times. And through the interpreter, he said, what did you have for lunch today? And the quality guy said, oh, I had, pizza, whatever he said. What'd you have for lunch yesterday? Oh, I had hot dogs. Okay. What'd you have for lunch last Tuesday? Geez, I don't remember. You can't remember what you had for lunch, he said, again, through the interpreter.
Yeah.
But I'm supposed to do something with this quality data? No good. NG. No good. Yep. Okay. Yep. That ties right back into your flow of information in terms of being timely. Is it current or old news?
That's right.
That kind of thing. So anyway, yep. I just thought that little anecdote because
Nikau
lives this stuff, John. This isn't just a bunch of... MBA bullshit, excuse my language, but this is not lean by PowerPoint. This is Nikau getting it and really changing how we think,
which is a blessing and a curse. It's both. So everybody wants data, but it turns into statistics that are almost useless.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
So the flow of equipment, this is an interesting one. So from my background, every day I wake up, I think about machines and equipment. It's something that I love. Even at my house here, I've got a big woodworking shop. I just love equipment.
I want to interview your wife sometime.
No, you don't.
Anyway.
So equipment. Even when I first heard it, thinking, what's a sensei driving at here? And then it started to click. And so what's not on the pages, and maybe I add it, but I thought I would start with this, is because, again, we think about our client in India, and their equipment has roots, what we call the roots. And Mark, yes. I don't know if you want to expand on what we mean by the roots right now. But one of the things that I told them in my old team in GE, all the old teams know this. Well, according to John, one of the biggest problems in manufacturing in the world, it doesn't matter what you make, is manufacturing never wants to change anything. Mm-hmm. They never go into, say, a new building or a new year thinking, I'm going to rearrange my line or I'm going to rearrange something. That's manufacturing's problem. And that's why so many businesses struggle making something. They just don't want to change anything. By contrast, we just talked about, say, Oracle or SAP. These people change something every third week. It's a 2.0, a 13.0, it's a something. And then by contrast, you've got manufacturing that never wants to change. So I say this to enter into equipment is you've got to think about the flow of equipment on how am I going to be flexible to keep changing things to meet my changing needs.
Well, John, so let me just go back to our friends in India, who, by the way, is a great client.
Yeah.
They have their manufacturing process is connected with sort of like an underground coolant and chip removal system. It snakes through the whole factory. It's almost like a river, you know, and all the equipment has to be tied to this particular, these channels in the ground.
Yeah.
And so you're not allowed really to pick up a piece of equipment, put it anywhere you want. You're tied into that. So when you talk about roots, that's one example of roots. Another example of roots could just be that, you know, you bolted down a piece of equipment. It's a battleship piece of equipment. It weighs 5 gazillion tons, and it's just bolted down, and it ain't moving. Okay, nobody's going to move it. Nikhil used to call those big pieces of equipment battleships, versus what he used to say, we need to buy PT boats. PT boats are very maneuverable, and I can move them anywhere I want. Yeah. Battleship will take forever, and they don't move because they're so big and all that. So. Yep. Exactly. So these are the kind of things we talk about with roots versus being a portable piece of equipment, because your needs are going to change. Your tack time is going to change. Your equipment capacity is going to go up and down. You may have to move a machine from point A to point B, whatever. You may do Kaizen and not need the cycle time and take that machine out and then put it in another line or another cell. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you need to be as flexible with that as you are with your wardrobe. I mean, right?
It's well said, Mark. And people should view equipment as another tool. Yeah. And so when I have the set of questions here, the first set, immediately we talk about roots.
Yep.
You're interrogating the machine. Do you have roots? And so we think about that for a minute. You just talked about the customer in India. Awesome people. It's a tough one because the whole shop is set up by the root system.
Yeah.
Yep. And so,
but by the way, can I digress here, John?
Please.
You in your moonshine shop, you took a piece of equipment and actually developed a self-contained coolant system for each machine that could be moved at ease right now. Why is that a big deal? It's a big deal because he can now control the coolant at the machine level, temperature, viscosity, everything else, right? Okay.
For that process need,
which is different than the one next to it. Okay. And when you have the coolant system flowing through the factory, you're subjected to whatever status that coolant has to be. Okay. Right. That happens to be at that particular point in time. And it changes. Right. And so, it has a huge impact on this thing we call quality.
Mark, you're spot on. So everything has to be purpose built.
Yeah.
Right. So even the coolant there's the purpose changes depending on the process. They all use coolant, but for a different purpose.
Yep.
And in a different way. Yep. So do you have roots? Are you on a foundation? Yep. Are you where you should be? Are you as close to the preceding and the following process as possible? Are you constructed for regular maintenance visits? Can maintenance tell by looking at you if you're okay? Are you maintained on a regular schedule? Who looks after you? Are they doing a good job? Do your caretakers look at your back so that the operators can work in your front? And so these are all these other concepts that Nikhil teaches. Mm-hmm. How are you feeling today? Are you noisy, leaky? Are you feeling so poorly that you're not operating? The flow of equipment.
I love the way you personalize each one of these flows, equipment, information, and all that. You're asking it as if it lies being. Hey, do you have roots? Yeah. How do you feel today? By the way, on that whole business about connecting the processes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Many times I see the mistake, and we should probably do another one on cell design, another episode. But I see that people like to line up their equipment nice and even, everything lined up perfectly. But by doing that, they create an immense amount of walk time for the operator. As opposed to trying to connect as close as possible the points that the operator has to interface with the equipment.
So what
That's what
happens?
really matters. This is not Hollywood. We don't care about what it looks like.
So I think what happens there, you either get a team that doesn't know or a bad coach, and they end up sub-optimizing things. You and I agree every day. We talk to each other on the Venn diagram view.
Right.
Everything's a Venn diagram. So look, if you just set up a line for optimizing the part flow, you're going to get into trouble if you forget this other stuff. If you just do it for a person, you'll get into trouble if you forget the other stuff.
Right.
And that's why the seven flows is so important, and to understand it as a bigger system that connects.
By the way, one of the things that and we could talk about this in cell design, but we would, when we were laying out a cell, we would make actual cardboard cutouts, real size of the equipment, not these little pieces of paper on some engineer's desk. We'd make them actual size of the equipment, the exact footprint, and we'd take a spray can of red paint and spray where the operator has to interface on that piece of cardboard. And then we throw the cardboard on the floor and tell the operators, okay, here's the order, right? Or you tell us the order of operations, and then connect the dots as closely and let them design the cell. Okay. Yeah. That's one thing that we would do.
We did the same. And then you get into, I think we're going to do more of these sessions, but modifying your machines, because there's no machine you buy that will facilitate any of this.
No,
none of it. So you've got to first modify and then build your own. But Mark, this is what it's all about.
And, by the way, we were the biggest Matsura house in the world at Jake Break when I was working there. We had more Matsura CNCs, but you know, they had their issues. And one of the things we did is the control panel, the arm would stick out into the cell.
Right.
Okay.
So
the operator had to walk around it. Yep. We actually had them redesign the machine so the control panel gets inserted into the machine when it's not being used.
Yep. And it needs to be on the other side so that when you do the counterclockwise flow,
exactly,
you're moving in the wrong direction to do something.
Exactly. Now, there's some things we could have done differently now that I think about it. And we did make an improvement, but like all improvements, they're always suboptimal.
Yeah, I know. We'll do a future session on that.
Yeah, okay.
And so I think we talk about equipment, so this connects to engineering. When I first heard the flow of engineering, so Sensei talking about the flow of engineering, it took me that week. I pondered it constantly. And so to Nakao, there is no organization called quality. So that's the first thing everybody should know. Yeah, everybody has a quality organization. I understand it. But what he said is, well, wait a minute. Engineering is responsible for quality.
Yep.
And he did not delineate between design engineering, manufacturing engineering, and he would never answer those questions.
Beautiful.
He would say, you have to figure that out. But engineering is responsible for quality. So for the flow of engineering, again, I talk about interrogating things, but especially in a shop in manufacturing, what you're primarily talking about with engineers is, Mark, we talked about inputs and outputs the other day.
Yep.
Engineering is responsible for inputs. And so not enough people think about that. So let me just elaborate on how I have my page set up here. Let me start with a gauge. Okay, so you have a gauge. It could be a CMM. It doesn't matter, but some type of a gauge. When we talk about single piece flow, it's a do check system. I did something, I check it, and you want to do one at a time. I did something, I check it at the pace of tack time. So if you're talking about a gauge, again, engineering is responsible for the inputs. Here's the big question. If you look at the gauge and you ask, are you in specification right now? I started with a gauge because this is the most problematic. my experience. Calibration cycles. Most gauges are on calibration cycles. And we know what drives it. It's because to check a gauge takes a while. The inspection lab is always constrained. In turn, this drives these intervals that the gauges get calibrated. Even when I started in aircraft engines in 91, a lot of the issues we had that had customer impacts, we would calibrate a gauge that was last calibrated 6 months ago, and the gauge was out of spec. So then, Mark, everything you made in the last 6 months is called into question.
Garbage. Yeah, right. Yeah. It's questionable.
Yeah. So one of the things that Sensei always drove me toward is getting to real time with gauges and tools.
Yep.
So am I in calibration right now? Now that gets to another concept that you've heard me talk about, calling a tooling diagnostic center. But this is part of the interrogation. And then I talk a little bit about the calibration cycle, but it's the same with the fixture. So the fixture is the quality. And so look, a long time ago in the Industrial Revolution, we made a transition from the era of craftsmen to the era of mass production, and tooling was the big enabler in that. So can I hold the part? Does it locate properly? Does it clamp properly? So it's the same question for the fixture. And so now we get into, if my old team ever listens to this, they're going to be smiling. The gauge is okay. I put more emphasis on making sure the fixture is okay. Again, it's inputs, Mark, right? So that fixture has to be perfect. And because you've got parts going in and out of fixtures, clamps moving, things happening, the fixtures are the first thing you should check constantly.
So let's just go back on that a minute. You said a manufacturing engineer's job is to control the inputs.
Yes.
The check in with a gauge after a machine's been processed, a part's been processed, is after the fact.
It is.
You're checking the fixture. That's the input, because that will be the one that causes the one of the things that will cause the defect.
And you know my basic philosophy. If you can control the inputs, you stand a much better chance at getting the outputs you want.
Right.
Everybody twists that up. And like, we're back to Gemba boards. Everything is focused on output. I think we're going to talk about metrics in another one of these podcasts.
Yes, we are.
Way too much focus on the why and not enough on the function of X or the inputs to the function of X. To me, this is all inputs. We've got to work inputs harder. The flow of engineering is about the inputs and controlling that. And that's on the page. Does engineering own the inputs? So we also talk about controllers. So again, I'm just going to go through this quickly.
Sure,
cutting
sure.
tools, same thing. Cutting tools all should have a life cycle. You should not drive a cutting tool to failure. Don't run your end mill until it's so dull it makes a bad part. So this should be more like how Disney has a program to change their lights before they fail. Nobody wants to pay a lot of money to go to Disney and see a bunch of lights that are out.
Yeah, we would do two life studies on all of our tools.
Yeah.
And it was part of our built-in process to say, hey, that particular tool can machine 22 parts. And after that, a signal came up and we would change that tool out.
Perfect. In our other podcast we're going to do, we get to metrics. So part of the poison there, there's some other function that's responsible for not spending much on cutting tools. That's the function that will drive the team to run the end mill to failure.
That's right.
Because another function is measured on scrap
cost.
Parts.
Yeah, right.
In the madness right. Build, right?
Right. Right. Hey, by the way, John, on gauges, go back to gauges for a minute. We learned something from Hino Motors because they were my customer. I supplied them at Jake Break. And Hino Motors, it was a two-bin gauge system. Yeah. Now, we know the international color in 5S for quality is blue. So what we did, John, is we had gauges everywhere at Jake Break. They were in engineers' drawers. They were in cabinets. They were everywhere.
I've seen that
So
before.
The first policy was nobody can be allowed to own their own gauge.
Yep.
All the gauges had to be controlled by the gauge room.
Yep.
We pulled all the gauges off the shop floor, and we wanted to have a duplicate set of every gauge. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what turned out is we had over $1 million of excess gauges when we matched them up.
Yeah.
And we only had to buy $40,000 worth of gauges to fill in the missing gauge. Okay.
Yep.
Now, and I know because I did the math on that. I was the CFO at the time. And so the way it worked was we had a light blue tray and a dark blue tray. And the gauges were presented at the right part in the cell. And the first day of every month, we switched out the trays. The dark blue came in and the light blue went out. Now they had a month to calibrate all those gauges. Now they may look at a gauge and say, oh, this one doesn't have to be calibrated until next month or 2 months from now. So they didn't calibrate it. They put it back in the tray.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
They have the stickers and all that. So they had 1 month to calibrate all those gauges. And so when the next first of the month came, we switched out the dark blue for the light blue.
Yep.
Okay. We were always in. And by the way, we had Marpos gauges at 10 grand a piece at the time. You know, I don't know what they go for now, but we had them in drawers. We were in Vidmar cabinets. They were in engineers' cabinets.
Right.
And it's like,
and
meanwhile, people are buying more gauges. Okay. It's like, oh, I need a Marpos gauge. They go out and buy another $10,000. Meanwhile, there's three of them sitting right next to them in some guy's cabinet. Okay. So we controlled quality that way, at least to make sure the gauges were, you know, that worked out very well for us.
This,
so
this is also important. Again, we're talking about the inputs. The final bullet I have here, and again, everybody's going to get the slides. Let me talk about a calibration that maybe if I use the word never, it's too strong, but I'd like to use it. One that never happens. Is the machine okay?
Yeah.
So think about this. You'll buy a new machine. There'll be a technical team. We'll go to the OEM and they'll do a runoff. They'll do a calibration runoff. And so one of my old teams in the last few years was a terrific machine shop up in Bangor, Maine. One of the things that we developed there and the other shops used is you've got to be able to run the same type of do a runoff or a calibration cycle in a short period of time on a very frequent basis. So we developed a whole routine to make sure that the machines were okay. So you're talking about, again, with the inputs, if the fixture is not okay, you're in trouble. If the gauge is not okay, you're in trouble, but especially the machine. So again, everybody thinks about TPM in a weird context too. We're not after failure modes. We're not after mean time between failures. We're after making sure nothing goes wrong in the beginning. So I'm also a strong advocate when we talk about the flow of engineering is they should also own the calibration of the machines, and it should be done on a regular schedule. So that's my final bullet on that one.
Awesome, John. Awesome. Awesome.
With people is the last one. So the flow of people. What I'd like to say about the flow of people, and this is something that we can never talk enough about, is all of their movement safe? A lot of times it is not. So the first thing to understand is anything we're asking somebody to do, is it safe? Then it gets into, we're back to the standards, Mark. And so one of the senseis told me, maybe I'll put this in my description here. I was in Japan at a Lexus plant, and one of the general managers spoke English fairly well. You know what he said to me? We could see the smile on my face. I'm just loving everything. And he said, do you like this? Yeah. And he said, do you know one of the things that we think we've done? We think we've replicated a biological organism. And stop thinking about that. And he went on to say that everything is for a purpose. You don't see a lot of waste. And he said, I'd like you to think more about that parallel. And so when you think about this with the flow of people, why did I bring that up? Because with the flow of people, you don't want unnecessary movement. So I get back to, when we talk about the flow of people, is any and all movement safe? Is any and all movement necessary? And again, you get into the interrogation. If somebody's moving, what tells them to move? So it should be a standard work accommodation sheet. But right. Okay, if they went from here to there, what tells them to move? Were they moving per instruction, or are they deviating from the plan and moving because something's not right, or they just decided to do something else? And that's what you're looking for. So what tells them when to move? What tells them where to move to? And is anybody moving in a non-standard condition? Are people moving without the instructions? So again, it's all about the safety, but what I like to do is maybe juxtapose this flow on top of the other one. So if you want people to move in a safe fashion and you're thinking about the layout, you've got to make sure that you know the route. Can people get where they need to be? Do they have enough egress space in case there's an emergency? So on and so forth, Mark. So I think that kind of concludes those points on the seven.
John, that was phenomenal. And by the way, a couple comments here. When it comes to people and you know what tells them to move, mm-hmm. one of the things that we were adamant about at Jake Break, and I didn't really see this too much in Japan, believe it or not, we would put mm-hmm. the standard work combination and standard worksheet at the operator's part of the work sequence. Yeah. We'd post it, okay? Now you say, okay, well, geez, Mark, why'd you do that? Because, well, I really, unless I can memorize every single, you know, combination sheet that changes when tack time changes, how do I know the operators are doing the right thing? How do I Right. know, by the way, how do I know if they know? What if somebody's out and somebody has to go substitute, right?
Right.
How do I know the supervisor knows, right? And I remember getting called out to a company, one of our companies in Cleveland, and they said, Mark, we set the cell up. We did a Kaizen, did the whole thing, and we're supposed to make 45 units a day. We can only get 38, Mark. What's going on? Can you come out and help us? So the first thing I did is I went out there, and I said, okay, show me your standard work. Okay, let's look at every operator. Bottom line was they had one operator out of like 10 operators in this line, in this cell. U-shaped cell, one-piece flow, right? At one operator out of like 10 operators, 10, 9 or 10 operators, forget. If you took his cycle time and divided it into the available time, it came out to 38.
No way.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
He was over tack time. Yeah. He was over tack time, John. He was over tack yeah. time. Okay. Yeah. So right. we had to redistribute the labor. We right. call it front loading. Right. We don't balance. We front load.
Sure.
And then we'll talk more about that some other day.
I subscribe to that too. Yep.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I tell you right now, I had lean people argue with me on it. You can't have somebody stand there and do nothing. Okay. And it's like, oh boy, you know, I said, look, the McDonald's has a sign. If you ever saw, if you have time to lean, you have time to clean. No, we want to make the waiting time visible. Well, everybody's going to get mad at that operator because they're only working half the time. Rotate your operators. Okay. We want to get multi-skilled, right. you know? And, but
I agree with every point, with every single point.
You got to tell the operator, yep. though, you're not dogging it. We just want you to stand there so we can see the visibility of this.
Exactly.
And every time I take time out of everybody else's cycle, I front load it so that that last cycle goes away, that last operator goes away.
Right. Otherwise, it's too hard to diagnose because the waste is in small bits and pieces in too many places.
You
want to see it in, yeah, you want to see it in one place. So we're back to, like, what is the purpose of a line is to expose the problems.
Exactly.
What is the purpose of setting up the standard work certain ways so you can see the issues?
You know,
we could do an infinite number of these podcasts.
Yeah, we should call it the Venn diagram of lean.
I
interviewed on a previous episode, Hide Oba, who is the son of Hajime Oba, who ran the Toyota Supply Support Center. God rest his soul, he passed away. But he came into Jake Break, and I worked with him. Yeah, I worked with his father. And something interesting that Jaime said, he said, standard work, you know, and by the way, I go back to the Danaher business system, and we put all the tools on the base of the house. We had SMED and TPM and all this stuff, right? And standard work was just one of the tools. What a mistake that was. And I'll tell you why. everything you do in a factory should contribute towards the operator meeting tack time per standard work. I mean, everything, right? Which right. means I can have bad quality.
Jobs. That's right.
Exactly. Okay.
Yep.
So if I'm doing a SMED, it's because of that. If I'm doing, if I'm putting a yellow tape on the floor, it's because of that. Yep. And when I don't, and this is what people don't get about standard work, it's a tool for improvement. It's not a tool to document your inconsistencies.
It's a tool for improvement. So if
if
you don't mind, I'm just going to do something to hold it to the camera. And again, in the last 5 years, my team has seen me do this a lot. Can you see that, Mark?
It's a little blurry. You might want to pull it back. It's kind of blurry. It's still blurry.
Sorry. It's concentric circles. Concentric circles. Really small in the middle and concentric circles outward.
Yep.
So the way I started to diagram this about 15 years ago, the problems with the house is you can argue what's in the foundation, what's a pillar. I started to draw it this way, and almost 100% of the time, people were in the middle.
Yep.
And so that's the center. That's what you're serving. And the outward rings are also things you do to serve the middle, and it helps you prioritize the inward first, the outward later. Anyhow, just something you made me think of.
I like that. I like that. Yeah, I like that a lot. By the way, and one more of the point about this whole business about visible information and all that. I was with it was a client one time, and I said, you know, talking about hour by hour boards and things like that. And, you know, I said, I can't tell the status of the cell by looking at, we know the status. Oh, you do? Yeah. We got an hour by hour board. We can tell you right to the date. Really? Where is it? I don't see it. Oh, we got it in our system. So he goes over to his computer. He logs in. Okay. He logs in. Okay. I go, oh, can I have that password? No, you can't have that password. How am I going to? Hey, look, it's not visible. It's in your system. Going back to Oracle and all these other systems, right? I can't see it. I can't see. If I can't see it, it doesn't exist.
So,
no, we got so that information. No, you don't.
Mark, it's interesting. It's interesting you bring it up. So for everybody, I'm just looking at my notes. These are the slides you can get. Recent technology has confounded information flow. So technology tends to drive information into secret places. I just call them secret places.
There you go.
And then that only a few can access. And so the problem I have with that is the team can't participate in Kaizen. That's what that leads to me.
No.
Yep.
One of the knocks I have on Six Sigma, by the way, which I have a white paper called the Six Sigma Hysteria. I'm not anti-Six Sigma, but the way it's been used and the way people think about it is... Well, it is a hysteria. Yeah, it's one of those silver bullets that everybody thought was going to save the world.
Yeah.
But anyway, John, this has been great. Let's stop it here. Otherwise, you and I will be you will miss your flight.
Yeah, we'll go all day.
You'll miss your flight on Friday to Australia, okay, if we keep talking. But the next one we're going to do is called what?
The Poison of Metrics.
The Poison of Metrics is going to be the very next episode. That will be episode 44. So stay tuned for that. John, this is awesome. So please email me at mark@lean911.com. mark@lean911.com. And we will provide these slides for you if you're interested in these seven flows. And any comments you have or any recommendations, please let us know, because your business system that you create at your company, if it's not subject to Kaizen, then you're not doing it right. You're not thinking about it right. It needs to evolve just like your company needs to evolve, just like you need to evolve. So anyway, John, thanks. mark@lean911.com. And we will get onto this other topic in a minute. See you next time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes.
email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.